Class is in session. You're listening to Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horshick.
Let's go!
Now, let's start the show.
Podcast listeners, thank you so much for checking out today's show. This is episode 35 of the Squat University podcast. The goal with each and every one of these shows is to bring you as much value-packed content to help you move better in the gym and in life, decrease your body's aches and pains, and help you reach your true athletic potential. Now, today, you guys are in for another great treat. This is another interview episode. I'm going to be joined today by one of the strongest men in the world today, one of the best power lifters in the entire world, and that is Kelly Brenton. I'm just going to give a quick introduction, and I'll let Kelly take it away. He is a seven-time Canadian national champion, a bronze medalist at the 2015, 16, and 17 powerlifting world champions, silver medalist at the 2018 championship, and is the first Canadian to squat over 900 pounds and bench over 600 pounds. So, one of the strongest guys in the world today, like I just said. So, Kelly, I'll let you take it away. Can you fill in just a little bit of background for the listeners out there who don't know who you are?
Well, thanks for having me on, first of all. Second of all, my name's Kelly. I'm from Canada, Windsor, Ontario. If you're from the States, it's right across from Detroit, right when you get off the Ambassador Bridge. I've been working out and doing strength sport, working out my whole life. I found powerlifting when I was around 21, and it's been a 10-year battle. I've won a couple Canadian national championships. I go to Worlds every year, and I'm going to keep working hard.
Awesome. Now, for all you guys out there that keep up with Squat University content, you may have seen the longer video content that Kelly and I put out just recently. When I was up in Toronto doing a Squat University seminar in early September, I had the pleasure to work with Kelly, who we had been going back and forth over Instagram a little bit, because Kelly had sort of in a rut with his heavier squats. In his quest to squat over 1,000 pounds, he had found himself in a position where he was battling some technique issues, just could not get past some certain problems, and he was developing a lot of pain. And we sort of put together an entire plan of how we found his weak links and how we're going about fixing it. So I want to start our podcast today with sort of talking about that, and then we'll get into a lot of other technical things. But Kelly, can you sort of, you know, let's start at the beginning. You know, going through your career, you're obviously seeing a lot of great numbers, a lot of great progress, and then you sort of hit this rut, especially with your squat and trying to get over that 1,000-pound barrier. Can you sort of touch on just sort of what you had been experiencing and the different things that you had tried to do up until the point of, you know, us interacting to try to fix the issue?
Okay, so when I was in 2010, I had no issues with anything back then. Like I never stretched. I never warmed up, didn't do anything, right? I hurt my back. I ruptured a couple discs. I was laid up for about 2 years. When I came back into powerlifting, it was about 2013. My back started to heal. I started to feel really good. And, leading into my first world championship in Finland in 2015, squat workouts for me, like specifically on the squat is when I have my most problems. There was absolutely like nothing I couldn't put on the bar and do. I could bury whatever I wanted. I had no problem with mobility. You know, people would say, what do you do? What do you stretch? I'd be like, I would be in the warm-up room and I would do like those like fake stretches you see people do, you know, just kind of like move the arms around and do a couple air squats. And then I'd get under 300 and squat 870. So it wasn't an issue, but I think, in 2015, a couple things happened. I started to gain, I think in 2015, I was about 320. So obviously being in the super heavyweight, it's an unlimited weight class. We have people like Ray Williams, Jezza, you know, you have to put on some weight if you want to compete. So I started to put on some weight, and I also started a sales job where I was sitting all the time. So I think since 2015 to 18, I'll say in about 2017, at the end of 16 is where I started to like be in the gym squatting, and I would feel like I would go as low as I can, but I wasn't. And if I would try to like force it, I would get all kinds of knee pain and back pain and Like it would, just wasn't good. So I would just kind of like squat a little higher in training. And then I'd always, like when I'm in the meet, just try to hit depth. And I mean, it worked for a while, but then it got to the point where the weights got so big when I tried to do that extra little bit. If you're not going those extra two or three inches in training, when your body goes to do them, it's like pulling the wind out of your sails, right? And every time I would be at the bottom of a squat and I would try to like bury it, my everything would shift over to the right. It would almost feel like I got hit with a sledgehammer, and my back would like, it would like tremor, and then my shifts would hip to the right. And like, I still always got the squats, but when I got up, I was like, man, there's, you know, I'm gonna get some serious problems if I don't fix this. So it happened in training a couple times. And I would be late. It's the same process every time. As soon as it happens in training or competition, it's 1 to 2 days where I can't get out of bed. I can't bend over. I can't even do anything. And then it's about 5 or 6 day process to stand up straight, not walk like hunched over. And by the second week I'm back to normal. So it wasn't like an injury where I'm breaking something or tearing something. It's like, I'm just, you know, like, blowing my discs up or whatever I was doing, because I would be right back at squatting 2 weeks later. So after, fast forward to the last world championship I was at, it happened when I was competing. I got home, took a rest, and it happened twice more. So I've followed Squat University since I had Instagram, and I'd always see the content you put out, and I always like, I would send people that, like, I coach your stuff, but I didn't do any of it. I would just be like, oh, that's cool. And then it got to the point where I talked to my coach, Mike Tashira, and it's no fault of his own. In 2 years, I don't even know how many times I competed. It felt like I always had a meet in 4 months, so I didn't have time to be like, okay, man, like, I'm going to rebuild my squat. It was like I just kept having meat, so I was like, I just kept hammering away. And I think he was kind of trying to pull me away from to do some deloads and not as many squats. And I was like, no, man, I got to keep going. And it all came to an end at, unfortunately, in Canada, in Calgary. But I mean, after we met in Toronto, and Mike gave me a ton of stuff in the same regards of the Stu McGill Big Three, mm-hmm. and all that stuff. So I kind of just took what you guys both gave me, smashed them together. And it's been amazing ever since.
I'm so glad to hear it. Now, you had tried a couple other, I guess, fixes for your body that just never worked, correct?
I mean, like, fixes, what do you mean?
As far like, didn't you say you had tried like myofascial release kind of things?
I tried myofascial release, and I don't, you know, I'm not an expert in this stuff. I just want to be told what to do and lift weights, right? Mm-hmm. If someone's telling me that this is going to make me better, perfect. So I before Finland, actually in 15, or no, it was before Texas, I think, in 16, I was going to get this myofascial release done. And I got it done on a Tuesday. I squatted on the Monday, got it done on a Tuesday. And then I got it done on a Thursday. And then on that Monday's workout, I went to squat, and it was a rep day. So I didn't have a heavy single, and my reps just kind of felt shitty. And then I went again on Tuesday and went again on Thursday. Then the next Monday I had a big squat. And at this time, I think, you know, my heavy singles leading up to that meet were all like 830, 850, no problem. I went in that day, I loaded, I think it was 770, my last warm up. I hit the bottom and I had no springs. I was just like, whoa, like it was mm-hmm. just scary. It's never happened to me. Like, I don't miss squats ever. So I was just like, yeah, this isn't working. It just stretched me out way too much. So after that, I was just mortified of stretching or like mm-hmm. doing any kind of, cause I figured in my head, I'm like, okay, I'm this big, you know, like ball of yarn. So when I'm at the bottom, I'm just bouncing off it. Right. It's mm-hmm. kind of slinging me back up. And then, when I got that, my hamstrings were like noodles.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing too, is with all the mobility fixes that we at least did, and, you know, things that we'll talk about here in a second, the goal is to make sure that we're improving the necessary mobility for you to do what you do and excel at, but not you know, stretch you out so much to where you lose that natural, you know, spring-like mechanism that makes you such a big athlete, especially when you've got 8, 9, 100 pounds on your back. If we did the same type of stretches in the extent that I would do for, you know, someone who's just trying to get more mobile to sit, ass to grass, you know, it's going to have a very different effect on your ability to perform. Now, I think one of the things that really, you know, sprung out to me was you always talked about it wasn't that it was necessarily a strength issue. It was that you had these mobility deficits that couldn't allow you to get deep. I remember, you know, saying that, you know, if you tried to push through those extra 2 to 3 inches, that's when the compensations occur. And even though I didn't need you to be as a powerlifter, you don't need to sit ass to grass in a, you know, very deep squat for your sport, but you need to have a sufficient amount of mobility to at least get that passive squat. And I remember seeing that video of you doing 1,000 pounds for the first time. I think, what was that, the Arnold's that you did that?
Yeah, and it was at the Arnold's.
You just, it wasn't that you weren't strong enough to do it. You just didn't have the mobility to even get down past that parallel position.
Yeah.
So, all right. So I guess what I want to do right now, I want to just briefly go over a few of the things that we did just in that first meeting. Just for the listeners that never saw that video on YouTube. And again, for everyone listening out there, go to YouTube under Squat University. It's just called Fixing Kelly Brandt. You can see this whole evaluation that we did. But one of the big things we did was look at first just your body weight squat. Because while obviously you compete with a barbell on your back, I think we all know now, like, it's got to be movement capability first. And I saw with your just body weight squat, you were still like, what, 3-4 inches above a parallel position.
Probably so, higher.
Yeah, exactly. So the one of the first tests we did was just looking at ankle mobility. And I threw you up against a wall in 5-inch test. So for you guys out there, you put your foot 5 inches from the wall, get down in a kneeling position. If you don't have a ruler, that's a fist plus an extended thumb usually. And our goal is to see, can you touch your knee to the wall? Now, obviously Kelly being a power lifter and he doesn't need to squat ass to grass, he still needs to get in that parallel position. What we're looking for is not necessarily, can he get his knee real far past his toe? Cause his knee's not going to go past his toe in the bottom of a squat, but are we seeing big compensations? And for him, not only did we see a big difference in ankle mobility, but we saw side to side, you had a big difference too. You had an asymmetry because you had an Achilles issue on your left side, correct, from years ago?
Yeah, it was like 2000. That was right before I started powerlifting in about 2009. I think I had done two meets then, and I severed my Achilles.
Wow!
Like completely sawed off, like foot hanging.
And so here's the thing for everyone to understand: even though, you know, Kelly's not a weightlifter, like I said, he doesn't have to squat ass to grass, there's still a sort of prerequisite level of ankle mobility that he still needs. Because if you don't have ankle mobility, as you squat down, that knee is not going to be able to translate forward sufficiently enough to let the hips sink and maintain that good core stability. Because what happens is that when Kelly was squatting down, because his shins weren't able to translate forward, and especially because he had that side-to-side difference, his body, A, wasn't going to be able to let those hips sink. And when he did try to push into that deeper position, his hips pulled under himself, so he lost pelvis and core stability. And then also he would shift side to side. And you said you would shift to your right side, correct?
Correct.
Which would make sense because the left side was the one that had even worse ankle mobility. So his body's naturally going to compensate and shift to the right side. So
right.
We could have done as much core stability work as feasibly possible. But if we never did any ankle mobility work, the core stability would always have broken down and that pelvis and low back would have lost its like firm, stable connection during the descent. And whenever you have 800-900 pounds on the bar, obviously that's going to have a dramatic effect on the different forces that are going to be placed on your spine, which is then going to, over time, create big issues. So one of the first things we did was just start working ankle mobility. And I think what we did is we did a partner foam roll or some soft tissue work because it was difficult for you to lay on the ground and foam roll your calves. Now, big thing for people out there, there's a lot of people that hate on foam rolling, but I promise you foam rolling is efficient and effective for most people that have sort of those stiffness in the back of the calf, as long as you're doing it, again, a minute and a half max. We don't need to be foam rolling for 10 minutes. And then we partnered it with just a simple lunge stretch to stretch out those calves. And the big thing is I wanted to keep those stretch times very short. Mm-hmm. What are we doing? We're doing 10, 20 seconds max, because mm-hmm. what we're doing is we're improving ankle mobility, but we're not going to decrease the natural stretch and spring-like ability of those calf muscles that we definitely need whenever we then get under the barbell. And I think just that alone, and then we partnered it again with a deep goblet squat stretch. I mean, right. it was a game changer for you in just that 20 minutes of learning. I mean, you were able to squat. I mean, how did it feel after we went through all that?
Well, let me just say real quick, after that session, like for me in my head, the way I think about everything, I was mm-hmm. like, okay, I'm going to take a year to get this mobility or whatever people talk about. I'm done. Like, this is going to be awful. And after one session like that, when you see that, like, I was always like, man, it's got to be my hips, right? Like, it's got to mm-hmm. be my hips are just tight. That's why I can't get down. I don't ever think about my ankles. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's no ankle curls. There's no way to work your ankles though. So I don't even think about them. And then when I was done that one session and I could get below parallel, I have not been below parallel on a bodyweight squat since I was 15. Okay. And then yeah. in one session I was below and I was like, wow, this is incredible. And then, I mean, like literally when I got home and started working out, like within three workouts, I was able to bury the squat and feel fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, I mean, and just look, I remember the look on your face after we did that. I'm like, all right, let's recheck your bodyweight squat. And I think you went 2 inches under parallel. And I think your eyes were just blew up. You're like, oh my gosh, this does work. And then I think the next thing we looked at glutes and core mm-hmm. stability, because mm-hmm. remember the big thing is that whenever you have pain, or a lot of people that develop pain in their back and in their hips, they often have inactive glutes. Now it's not that they are not firing at all, because the glutes are still there for posture. If you didn't have glutes turning on at all, people would fall over. But it was that they weren't firing in good coordination, turning on at the right time, or maintaining a specific tension that we need for them to be the main driver of hip extension, which is driving up from the bottom of the squat. We just did a simple single leg bridge test. So you lay on your back, you put one leg out in front of you, and you bridge up, you pick your butt up, and we just hold for about 10 seconds. And our goal is to feel what muscles are turning on the most. What are you right. feeling the most? And I remember, I'm pretty sure you felt your hamstrings and then also your back, correct?
My lower back, yeah.
Exactly. So that means that a movement of hip extension is automatically placing more force on the back than it should. So if you think about it, if you're just with a body weight movement like that, feeling tension in your back, what do you think is happening when you do a 500, 600, 700 pound squat? You know, that same movement of hip extension is automatically placing a lot of force on the low back, and it's not handling it correctly because the glutes aren't that main driver. So again, what we did was we just did a double leg bridge. We sort of regressed back to the more simple version of the bridge, drove the heels into the ground, put a band around the knees. I think you have, do you have one of the Mark Bell hip circles? Is that what you use?
Yep.
Yeah. And just, you know, that corrective exercise alone, you know, doing a couple of those, squeezing the butt muscles, getting those firing, and then doing that first set under the barbell with some, are you still doing that? Some pauses with the band around the knees? Yeah, I mean, right there, I think
I actually do that, but I keep it on. I warm up to about 500 with it on.
That is awesome. I love that. I started using a band within the past year, and I usually do my first one or two sets with the band around my knees. And it just, you know, it's almost like that mental cue to, you need to be able to create that core in glute stability and driving those knees out, feeling those glutes turning on. And when they do, they're creating that tension in the hip, so that when you do squat up and down, it's just like, you know, the springs just getting, you know, tensioned and then releasing all of a sudden. So it makes
I think what that specifically has helped me on is mm-hmm. that I think because my glutes weren't firing, I was always tipping forward more to compensate.
Yeah, exactly.
So now that I squat, I feel like I'm way more up and down. Mm-hmm. And I feel like at the bottom, I'm turning it on like in my glutes and hamstrings more than just like leaning over to try to get that for sure has an effect.
Yeah. Well, and the thing you just said that caught my mind is that you said that you feel more upright. I remember reading a piece of research recently, and it was looking at sort of the kinematics, the technique, biomechanics of some very elite powerlifters versus non-elite mm-hmm. powerlifters in a meet. And they found mm-hmm. that the athletes that were the most elite in the squat were actually mm-hmm. more vertical in their yeah. trunk position than not elite ones.
Well, the example of the before I knew this stuff, I was always a lean over squatter.
Yeah.
I know a lot of big guys are, but I mean, the prime example of a guy that stays upright is Ray Williams.
Yeah.
Like I can't believe he can stay that upright, hit the hole with 1,050 and come back up like that.
Crazy.
So I was always like, man, I wish I could stay more upright, but I would always lean, but
yeah.
He's an example.
Yeah, exactly. Now, so we basically took that time in Toronto. We broke down your body. We found the weak links and then we devised the plan. Now I remember one of the things we talked about was whenever we devise these plans for corrective exercises, usually while you may see, especially with the mobility, some changes, you know, dramatically within that first couple minutes, you know, the real fixes, especially in core stability, they take time. They take, you know, mm-hmm. weeks and weeks and months and months.
Mm-hmm.
But I know, you know, when you told me how you had been staying, you know, dedicated doing them, can you just talk about like your sort of day-to-day training program right now, week to week? How do the corrective exercises that we talked about, how are they fitting into your schedule and how are they going, I guess, with your training now?
So before, I actually do them before bench day two.
Okay.
It actually makes me feel way better on the bench just because I'm like, I use the same warm-up for squat, bench, deadlift day. So 4 days a week, I do your warm-up,
mm-hmm.
Along with some other stuff. And then, at night, two or three nights a week, I'm also doing like a kind of a regimen at night. So, but like, it's like, even like if I've been doing a little cardio in the morning,
mm-hmm.
like I'm not running, but I'm just, you know, doing like some bike or something. I'll always get in like before I get going, I'll always get in like, it's called a goblet squat.
Oh yeah.
Goblet. I'll always do that in the morning when I wake up and whatever. That's my favorite one.
Yeah.
It feels like I release all my hip pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, I just, every morning I do that one for sure. Jump on the bike for sure. Four times a week before I'm warming up in the gym, I'm doing that whole routine. And then at about two or three nights a week, I'll get before I go to bed and just, you know, do it before bed too.
Awesome. Now tell me about your experience with the McGill Big Three, because a lot of athletes, they look at the Big Three, which for the listeners out there, it is the modified curl up, the side plank, and
yeah.
the bird dog. Now to the outside looking in, the listener, you know, a lot of times they're like, oh, those are just so simple movements. That's, you know, I want to get to the barbell. I want to lift big weights. I don't need to, you know, waste my time with the Big Three. But when you're doing them correctly, it's a workout in itself.
If you do them right, like I got a nice sweat ring around my neck when I'm done.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing I found. It was kind of interesting is I didn't do that mm-hmm. at the start before I squatted.
Yeah.
Okay. And I mean, the depth was great. Everything felt good, but I just kind of was like, kind of my bad. You know, I felt good on ankle and everything, but
mm-hmm.
about two weeks ago, I was like, I'm going to start throwing them in before I work out.
Yeah.
So when I did, those Big Three before I work out, what I found was when I picked the barbell up on my back, I felt a lot more stable
mm-hmm.
and I felt like up my spine was like it was activated, especially
yeah.
I think from those Supermans, you'd call them, or bird, what are they called?
The bird dog.
Bird doggers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The bird dogs. Like, I feel it activates my lower back and like up my spine. So when I got out, I felt a lot in my core too.
Yeah.
So it just feels a lot better.
Yeah.
When I get to my top set, sometimes I'd walk out and it'd be like, you know, a little wobbly, but I feel really, really secure after I do those. So that's in the tool belt for sure.
Yeah, I think the big thing that McGill always talks about with the Big Three is that they're simple exercises, but when you do them correctly, they prime your core, all parts of your core, the front, back, side to side, the barrage to hit all parts, and you're actually going to have a lasting effect for the next couple hours. Your core is that much more tensioned and stable. So if we're talking about before a big workout, I mean, it has a huge effect for a strength athlete to put in these type of sort of primers before a workout, for sure.
Yeah, it's so simple, but it's just so effective. I just, It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Can I guess last thing, you know, as far as the injury aspect and things like that go, before we get into some other things, can you touch on just sort of how this whole process of having sort of the injuries, the problems with your technique? Before you said you know, people would ask you, you know, go warm up, and you're like, oh, I'll just sort of flail my arms and pretend to warm up. And then now, with your new understanding of the body and how you feel after these different corrective exercises and things, can you sort of touch on how has your perspective changed, you know, from 2 years ago to now in how you view powerlifting, your body, and just how you need to train it?
Well, I mean, for me, I'm sure there's not a lot like me, because I mean, everyone does warm ups and, you know, exercises and stuff. And like I say a million times, I got away with it for a long time, 'cause I just loaded it up and squat, bench, or deadlift it. Like, that was it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at the end of the day, I'm 32 years old. I've been doing this for 10 years. The body doesn't go, you know, I'm only getting older, and what's happening is I have to find every little avenue to make myself better, whether it's, you know, doing warm-ups before, little stretch at night, you know, walking, getting the hips tight. So now that I know all this stuff, I wish I would have been doing it before. I wish somebody would have sat me down and tried to make me do it, but that was just my own, you know, not asking for help and just kind of, you know, doing my own thing. But man, like, life is better when you're warmed up like that. Like,
for sure.
But I always thought, you know, like, people, like, you know, I'd see, like, you know, when you're in high school, it's like, I never stretched before football or nothing. I just thought stretching was bad. Mm-hmm. So I'd see people do these like hamstrings and stretch everything out, and every time I'd do it, I'd feel like I get hurt.
Yeah.
So I just like, but the mobility stuff is just like, when you're talking about, you look at someone and they're 3 inches high. My whole life, I tell everybody, I'm like, I can't even, I got to get over 700 pounds to get near depth. Like, I could never make depth with 3 plates if I tried.
Yeah.
So now, like, you tell me to do like these ankle mobility drills and bang, bang, I'm 2 inches under in one day, man. That's amazing stuff, man.
Yeah. It's funny how, you know, perspective's always, what is it? They say hindsight's always 20/20, and we wish we knew now, or, you know, back then. And, but you know, I'm so happy to hear the way in which you're approaching things now, because I think it's going to have a dramatic effect on not only your performance, but just quality of life in general. You know, I mean, we always talk about, you know, performance first, and that, you know, your job is being a power lifter and lifting big weight. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, we also got to talk about just being a human and, you know, being a person. You want to be able to live your life and not have to wake up in pain every single day, you know?
That's right.
So,
yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. I definitely feel a lot better too. Like, yeah. It's like just walking around and getting that mobility in, getting out of bed feels a little better. So there's only up from here.
That's so awesome. All right. So let's switch gears and talk about some other stuff. I saw recently on Instagram, you have a 12-week program that you just put out. Can you just briefly talk about sort of the approach that you're taking and teaching others as far as training, periodization, and programming goes?
So it's on my strength book. It's one of, it's Team Canada's head coach and another guy, Mike McDonald and Avi Silverberg. They, created my strength book. It's, it pretty much tracks your training. It does your metrics. It shows your volume weekly. It's just, it's got so much stuff. I'm not going to go on and on about the app, but if you're an athlete and you're looking for something you want to put in and log something for the rest of your life and go back 3 years ago and see what you were doing, it's there. So what we do is, they have coaches on there. So we write up programs and then throw them on there, and anybody can go and just be like Kelly Brand's 12-week peak, pay whatever, $27 a month. You put in your maxes and bang, you got a 12-week peak program. So what I've done is I've written other programs, and they were successful, but the feedback that people give me is like, I try to write a program for like the general, right? Mm-hmm. Not a program that was like, 'cause you know, everybody's a little different, and people are like, man, I want to try what you were doing. Like, I want to do what you do.
Yeah.
So I literally wrote a program that was like, it's a tough program. Like there's, you know, there's some bench workouts where you're doing 10 for 10s.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, it's pretty much what I'm doing, peaking before Worlds. And yeah, like I think last time I launched a program, I think I had like 4 or 5 people the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And then this time I had 38 sign up in one day.
Wow.
I don't know where we're at right now, but like for me, that was pretty big. I was pretty excited about it. So it's literally a squat, bench, deadlift twice a week, one main squat. Then you're going to do like either a safety bar or a tempo squat. So it'd be like an accessory. Same with bench. You bench twice a week, one high volume day, super high volume, and then one kind of heavy day. And then deadlift, same thing. You have a main deadlift day, and then you're going to deadlift after you squat, which will be like, you know, either tempo or pause. But it's a pretty killer workout.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, you said this is about a 12-week program. Is that pretty typical for you to sort of put together a 12-week program for yourself as far as when you're trying to get ready to peak for a meet? Or do you usually go extend that for a little bit longer? Like, when do you start really hitting, you know, your peak programming?
So for me, the way that I would do it is those 12 weeks, I'd probably have a deload in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd probably go like, you know, 5 or 6 weeks and then deload and then, you know, ramp it up. But the way that my body works and the way that me and Mike Tashir have kind of figured out is that I kind of, as week 6 comes, is where I start to like, kind of go like a week 7, I would start to go down the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of am like in a, I'm a 6-week guy. So what we do is we try to set up our cycles for the 6 weeks, your 6-week ending on your competition.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, like, I mean, you're peaking pretty much like 16 to 23 weeks out, right? But you're not hitting your huge numbers, then it's all building towards that.
Mm-hmm.
But like me, I can ramp it up, go. And then after 6 weeks, I kind of need a deload. That's how my, some people are 4 weeks, some people are 8, but I've just figured out that after 6 weeks of going hard to the paint, I need a deload and then I go back up.
Gotcha. Now, as far as like manipulating volume and intensity, do you notice that you need to use a specific difference in volume as far as your bench, squat, and deadlift? Like, or do you keep those pretty much very similar in your programming?
No. My bench volume is like off the charts.
Yeah.
And my squat volume, I would say, has always been for a big guy. I've talked to a lot of supers. I do a lot more squat volume than most of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd probably say I'm about 8 out of 10. And then deadlift, just because of the injuries I've had with the 2 ruptured discs and the way my back is. And that's another thing is if I bobble a squat, say like not injure it, not like at the bottom, but if, you know, you kind of go up and you bobble and wiggle, that'll set my back off for Thursday and I can barely pull. So
gotcha.
That's why squat's so important for me, to have good technique and everything rocking and rolling, because if I'm in a competition and I do that on the deadlifts, I'm screwed.
Gotcha.
So I have to be perfect anyway. So, and then on deadlift, I would probably say I'm a very low volume lifter.
Mm-hmm. How was your deadlift technique coming along? I remember we had a conversation, for all the listeners out there, I'll probably set a little bit of background. I remember you messaged me and you were having an issue with your underhand grip arm during the deadlift because you weren't able to fully externally rotate, and we found with some testing that you had a little bit of a restriction in your lats that wasn't allowing full external rotation. So we did a little bit of foam rolling, I think, for the lats, and maybe a light stretch. How's that been
foam rolling for the lats? I haven't really got super heavy yet, so, but I still feel I need to work on that hand. Well, the other thing is like I deadlift on Thursday and I do high volume bench Wednesday.
That would make sense.
So I think I think it kind of, you know, I feel like in competition I'm a lot better because I'm not benching the day before 100 sets. But like when I go to deadlift, it's still turning my hand. It's still kind of like I can tell on my like first 4 warm-ups, it feels like my left hand's out 4 feet.
Gotcha.
That makes sense.
Yeah, for
you.
Sure.
So I still got to keep working on that and get more flexible.
Yeah. So for the listeners out there, whenever someone's approaching the bar for a deadlift, and if they're using sort of a mixed grip as far as their pulling method, that underhand grip is going to require a little bit a more external rotation to get that thumb to point out. And the lats are very, very powerful internal rotators of the arm. So if you have a lot of lat stiffness and restrictions in there, it's going to limit your ability to turn your hand all the way to the side to open your palm up forward so you can grab the bar sufficiently. So one thing that we can do is just some light foam rolling or get a lacrosse ball up into those lats. And then also there's some stretches that I've shown on Squat University Instagram or on my website, squatuniversity.com. But just different things like that can be really helpful, because if we can't, just like with the squat, get into a good position movement-wise before we load it, obviously it's going to lead to some more issues up the chain. So something like that, if we didn't address it with Kelly, could turn into like a shoulder issue, an elbow issue, or even a wrist issue because we're trying to push into a compensated position. I guess my next question for you, obviously you've been in the powerlifting game for over 10 years, you know, very elite in your training style and how much load your body can handle in training and competition. What's your advice for a powerlifter or someone that wants to get into powerlifting? You know, we would consider them even a beginner, someone who's been in the sport for, you know, 1 to even 4 years. What's your advice as far as programming? And, you know, people have questions as far as how much they need to push themselves or how often they need to train. What's your advice for that new lifter that wants to get in as far as training goes?
I'm so happy you asked this, and I hope a lot of new lifters find this, because it's one of the things that bothers me the most about powerlifting these days is that kids join up for powerliftings and, you know, day one they want to be Ed Cohen. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, when I started, I didn't even know. I had a wrestling singlet on in case with shoes I used to cut the grass. And I went out there and did a competition, and it was equipped, and I didn't even know what that was.
Yeah.
So I just went out there and I just squatted, bench, deadlift. I had a great time. I remember me and my mom went there. Like, I was with my mom.
Yeah.
And we showed up to this meet, and I lifted. I had a great time. They gave me a second place medal, and I was like, this is sweet. And then I was like, all right, I want to keep training. And I think the main thing is kids get so messed up at the start because they want to, like, okay, I want to peak. I want to get a coach. You know, I want to do this and this and this. Now, you know, I want to do this meet, and I want to take 2 years till I get strong. And it's just like, man, if I had any advice for someone that's just starting brand new, first of all, there's nothing wrong with getting a coach. First of all, you got to vet your coach. You got to make sure he's a credible coach. You got to make sure it's someone that's not just going to steal your money. But I wouldn't even get a coach to start. I would go online and do the most basic 5x5 programming. Do 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You know, there's tons of easy programs. You can just put your numbers in and it'll spit you out a program. And honestly, man, like, just don't worry about a peak for the meet. Just show up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you start worrying about cutting weight, or this guy from this region's going to come here and, like, you know, I'm going to wait 2 years till I get stronger. It's just, you're never going to do it.
For sure.
So get in front of it. You know, don't worry about a peak. Just kind of be in the gym and get the basics down and go have fun, you know, do your first meet and just feel what powerlifting's all about, man.
Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, I remember when I first started in weightlifting in 2005, and my coach was just like, hey, you've been training for a couple of weeks. Let's just go have fun. Like, you got to get out there and just experience what a meet is. You know, you get up there and you got three mm-hmm. lifts and that's it, but you got to understand it. Like, it should be fun. And I think too many people are like, well, I'm going to wait until I can, you know, clean and jerk 140 kilos and then I'll do my first meet. And it's like, look,
right.
Like, just go out there and have fun, and whatever you do, like, you gotta experience the meet and what it's like. And I think you're going to learn a lot, because lifting in the meet's very different than lifting in training.
That's right. And in losing is learning.
Exactly.
You know, yes. Like, losing is learning. Like, you know, very few people will win every competition they're ever in. Losing is learning. What did I do wrong? Assess it, come back, get better.
Yeah.
You know? And if you want to talk about getting a coach and doing perfect peaks, and you're going to get all messed up doing your first local competition, if you want to put that much pressure on yourself for your first comp, I can't imagine the basket case you're going to be when you're competing at a international meet.
100% agree.
You know what I mean? Like, just save the stress for when you're at Worlds, because it's stressful.
Yeah, oh, I enough. Bet.
Okay, so just have fun at the start.
Yeah. So let's go on the opposite end of the spectrum. What considerations and different things would you have to say for the master athlete, you know, the person that's been lifting for a while, you know, as far as, you know, the training styles and different things, what do you have to say for the master athlete?
Do you say master as like someone who's not an open, or you say someone who's been doing it for a
while? Let's say someone who's been doing it for a while.
Well, I think the word there is being durable, mm-hmm. and being someone who's open-minded to new things.
Yeah.
I've learned stuff through my career. Just because you're the best lifter doesn't mean you're the best coach.
Agreed.
Just because you're the best lifter doesn't mean you know everything.
Mm-hmm.
I've picked up tips from people that, like, I don't even know how to say it. Like, someone who's just a regional competitor has given me a tip, and I'm like, holy shit, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Or like, they're like, hey man, like, you know, I heard you're having this, like, why don't you try doing deficits? Or, you know, it might not be, you know, you got to open your mind, and like, obviously you're going to get bad information and good information, but you got to like see who's giving you it first of all. But you know, the best powerlifters I know are the ones who are like, you know, open up your mind and talk to people in the back room. And I don't know if you've, I don't know how weightlifting is, but powerlifting, man, like, you know, 95% of the people are so nice and open talk to you about training protocols and everything. Yeah. And, you know, there's some bad apples everywhere, but you know, I've literally learned everything I did from the internet, messaging top end lifters and figuring it out, you know? But if you're closed minded and you think you know it all and your total's going nowhere, it's going to stay nowhere.
Yeah.
So that's all it is.
Well, I think, you know, the big thing, no matter how elite you are, no matter how long you've been in whatever game you are in, being humble enough to listen to other people is what it's all about, you know, because I always say, you know, the only way to become a master is to never stop being a student. And if you're not open to like learning new things just because you've been in the game for 10 years, like, what about the person that's, you know, what are you going to think when you've been in the game for 20 or 30 years? Like, you should always be open to learning new things.
Well, that's exactly it. And then if you look at, like, I'm not trying to compare myself to these people, I'm using it as an example, but Tiger Woods has a coach.
Yeah.
LeBron exactly. James has a coach.
Yeah.
So like, they're always trying to get better, even when they're the best in the sport.
Exactly.
So if you're not willing to do that, then you're going to have someone come up and beat you, or your total's not going to go anywhere.
Exactly. Exactly. So I want to take this next question. Who were some of the people that you looked up to when you were getting into the sport? Who were the people that sort of were the way that you wanted to train? You wanted to be that person. Obviously, you mentioned Ed Cohen before. Who are some of the other people in the game of powerlifting that were big influences on you?
So there's a powerlifting documentary I watched in 2008. It's called Powerlifting Unlimited.
Okay.
You can watch it on YouTube, I think. I have the DVD still. I have two copies actually. And there was a guy named Kurt Karwalski, mm-hmm. if you've ever heard of that name. Mm-hmm. He's just like, when I seen him in that DVD, I was like, okay, I'm going to start powerlifting. Like, I just watched it, his like intensity, his mentality. And then it was just like finding anything I could, articles on him, like just the way he walked up to the bar and almost like took over the room was just so powerful. The way he was just such an intense lifter, and he got it done all the time. I think his 1,000-pound squat's frozen before the new weight classes in the 275. I think it's still frozen.
Oh wow.
Like, he was, you know, he was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
He was there's a famous line, because he lifted with Ed Cohen back in the day. They'd lift in the same comp at senior nationals.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Cohen squatted, I think he out squatted Kirk somehow. Kirk missed his last attempt, and then Kirk said to him, he's like, yeah, but I tried more than you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just like, wow. His mentality was just awesome.
Yeah.
He was somebody I really looked up to. And in my little world in Windsor, there was a guy named Tim Eckert. He was a blind lifter.
Mm.
That's how I started in powerlifting, with Ontario Blind Sports and Canadian Blind Sports.
Okay.
Before I powerlifted, I was a assistant coach for Team Canada. And I traveled around to the OBSA Blind Worlds, and I was at the Blind World Games and everything, and just seeing what he went through day to day. And then I remember one day I tried to squat 500 with my eyes closed and I dumped it.
Oh, wow.
You know, yeah. It's just like, I can't imagine never being able to see and then telling someone, hey man, go get under 600 and squat it. Yeah. Right.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah. So there's guys like him and, you know, there was a guy named Alex Mardell in Canada. I looked up a lot to a girl. She's just competed and got silver at the world yesterday. Mm-hmm. Rhea Stinn. And then Kimberly Walford was a huge one. And then I looked up a lot to Blaine and Ray when they were when I was laid up hurt.
Yeah.
I was following those guys like crazy on the internet. Mm-hmm. So those, you know, I remember seeing a video of Ray coming out and he was, I think he squatted 900. He had a blue singlet on and there was like gold plates and he just squatted it no problem. And
I think I know that video.
Yeah, he didn't wait for the rack command and he just squatted it and everyone was like, oh, you gotta wait for the rack command. And I was like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Like he just squatted nine. That was unheard of.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Those were gear numbers, and this guy just came out of, you know, Mississippi and oh yeah, I'll do a meet and just squatted nine. It was nuts.
Crazy, crazy.
Yeah.
All right. So last question for the day, because I know that you gotta get going. Let's switch this up. Obviously, this is Squat University, but I know that you are one of the best benchers in the world as far as numbers yeah. you're putting up. I want to know, what advice do you have for bench technique?
Okay, so the biggest – okay, first of all, no, without technique, if you're not doing volume on bench, you're not – like you're not doing bench. You got to do volume. You got to get in your 10s and 8s. You got to get out of the unconventional thinking low rep and powerlifting. When I started doing volume, that's when my bench went from 550 to 600.
Wow.
Okay. You have to do volume. Biggest bench tips, I'd say, you got to squeeze that bar like you're going to like feel like you're trying to tear the middle and rip it apart. And then take your lats. You got to make sure your lats are touching and then take them and try to put them in your back pockets of your jeans. So you put them, tighten them up, and then you put them in your back pockets. Hold that bar. When you squeeze a bar and your hand's squeezing, it tightens up everything on your chain from your hand to your chest, to your lats. That's the biggest thing. The second biggest thing is using your legs with your bench. So getting some, you know, it's a full body thrust. You obviously can't let your butt come up, but getting like a pulse from your legs, pushing through your feet. Think instead of pushing down on them, pushing out like you're kicking a carpet away. And that'll keep your butt from coming up and you can get some push out of your legs.
That's awesome, man. Thanks so much. I know many people have not heard any of that content from me, because obviously I try to stay more with the things that I know well.
It's the new Instagram account. It's called Bench University.
Kelly's starting it tomorrow, everyone.
Right.
All right, man. So here's the deal. What is next for you? Obviously, are we setting our eyes on Arnold's next year?
So we're going to set our eyes on Arnold's, and that's all. Like I took a pass this year at Ontario's. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be at the Arnold's. I'm pretending I'm a new lifter now. I'm going out there. Obviously I want to squat 1,000 pounds, but I'm going to open up a little lighter. I'm going to make sure I get all my squats. If the 1,000's there, it's getting loaded, but you know what? I'll be happy with a 950, 970
yeah.
personal best squat, personal best bench, and a personal best deadlift. I'm going to chip this total away till powerlifting's done with me. I'm going to put it up as high as I can and do the best I can. And I've never felt better. And it's thanks to guys like you, man. You didn't have to mesh me back. You didn't have to help me. You didn't have to bring me to Toronto. And I sure do appreciate it.
Man, that's what I'm here for. And it's been awesome getting to know you over these last couple months and just seeing the change in the way that you're approaching it. It's awesome to see, and I'm pumped to see how you continue to progress, because I know with that mentality, man, the sky's the limit. And I 100% believe that 1,000-pound squat is around the corner, and when you hit it, it's going to be smooth. It's going to look so good, man.
Just got goosebumps.
I promise it's going to be there. All right, so here's the deal. For everyone listening out there, I want you to go follow Kelly on Instagram. Kelly, what's your Instagram handle? Is the Great White North Juggernaut, correct?
Great White North Juggernaut.
There you yep. go. Go follow and Kelly on Instagram.
Hey, listen, some people get this thing like it's because I think I'm great and I'm white. It's not. It's because Canada's the Great White North. And then I just put Juggernaut with it. So, okay.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you so much, Kelly, for taking the time out of your busy day to come and sit and talk with me over this podcast. I hope everyone out there listened, got something out of it. And yeah, if you guys did enjoy the show, please share it with your friends. Tag on Instagram, Squat University, so I can personally reach out and thank you for that. And thank you for listening to the show. Until next week, guys, happy squatting.
See you, buddy. Perfect. Take care.
There we go. All right. See you, man.
That's it for today, class, on Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horschig. For more exclusive content, log on to squatuniversity.com.